Welcome to War Room, the official podcast of the U.S. Army War College online journal, graciously supported by the Army War College Foundation. Please join the conversation at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. We hope you enjoy the program.
Hello and welcome to the War Room podcast. I'm Andrew Hill and I'm joined today by Mr. David Bennett. David, welcome to the War Room podcast.
Oh, Andrew, thank you for receiving me here today.
So David has joined us to talk about the Vietnam War. David is a Vietnam veteran. He served in the United States Marine Corps. He served two tours in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot. And following his service in the Marine Corps, had a distinguished career in the State Department, serving over 28 years. At the end of that career, he was a member of the Army War College faculty and has been a part of our community here almost ever since. Correct, David?
Absolutely.
So, David, welcome, and I'm going to start by asking you a really general question that you can take any way you want, but I want to ask you, what did the Vietnam War mean for you personally?
At the time, Andrew, the Vietnam War gave me the opportunity to go from an illiterate corporal in the Marine Corps to becoming a pilot and an officer and serving the U.S. in a different capacity. The Vietnam War opened up a need for additional resources, human resources primarily, the recruiting of and the redrafting of additional Americans gave me the opportunity as a corporal in the Marine Corps at that time with frankly very few onward options to go to flight school, to receive a commission, and to become a pilot. And I took that as a vote of confidence on the part of the Marine Corps in the abilities they perceived that I had.
So let's start with the illiterate part of that, because I've known you since I came to the War College in 2011, and you're a really learned guy. So how did you find yourself in a position of feeling illiterate? How did you get there?
The language, Andrew. I grew up in France. My mother was British, my father American, yet all my friends were French. My schooling was in French. I resisted speaking and reading in English. As a consequence, when I came to the States in 1961, my English language skills were very poor, and my scholastic success in my 1 year of American high school were, should I say, not worthy.
Needs improvement probably would be our modern terminology for that.
Needs significant improvement. Yeah. So my prospects of going to university or doing bigger and better things at that time were extremely limited. We had a draft in America in 1962. And so I assumed that at some stage I would be drafted to serve in the armed services. And because of a personal connection with a friend of my father's, I elected to join the Marine Corps. And that was an interesting choice. I still spoke very poor English with a very strong accent when I went to boot camp. And that did not endear me to the drill sergeants, but I survived that. So again, the issue, Andrew, is that as a young corporal in the Marine Corps, with no further education than a very mediocre 12th grade in an American high school, my prospects for life were very limited. The Marine Corps, by letting me go to flight school, by commissioning me, gave me a boost of self-confidence, and following my time in the Marine Corps, I entered university, did quite well, but I was also 8 years older. It opened up a significant window in my life, which allowed me then to become perhaps more educated, more informed, and more engaged with other matters than just being a corporal carrying a radio in the Marine Corps, talking to airplanes and helicopters for a living.
So before you went to Vietnam the first time, what were you expecting?
Before, upon completion of flight school?
Right. So you're a helicopter pilot now in the Marine Corps, and you're being deployed to Vietnam the first time. At that time, the Marines had been there for 2.5 years. This is, I think, 1967, you mentioned in our discussion before we started recording. What were you expecting? I mean, Americans at that time, they knew a little bit about the war. What did you think you were going to find in Vietnam? And how much did it conform or not conform with your expectations?
It conformed for the first few weeks. essentially what we had heard back in the U.S. in military circles was how wonderfully well the war was going, the great successes that our armed forces were enjoying in Vietnam. And as a member of a Marine squadron of helicopters, I would be going out and helping the ground forces to prosecute their part of this great successful war. I had, in earlier years, read a lot about the French Indochina War and had come out very disillusioned on how the French had not successfully prosecuted that war. It was a colonial war. Nonetheless, it was prosecuted in a standard army-type war. Shortly after coming into Vietnam, I believed that we were prosecuting, we the U.S., were prosecuting our war the same way the French had. And very soon after my arrival in Vietnam, I wrote to my mother, who was living in France, and saying, we're not going to win this war. We're making the same mistakes the French made, only on a larger scale. But that mattered less to me as what I felt my responsibility was to my fellow Marines on the ground or my fellow Marines in the helicopter squadrons. The Tet Offensive happened shortly after I got to Vietnam, and I participated in flight operations in support of fighting against the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong. And that was my challenge. How can I best support the Marines on the ground and my fellow Marines in the squadron that I was flying with?
Was it difficult for you to reconcile your sense of the strategic problems of the war with your immediate commitments in terms of at the tactical level? Obviously, as a junior officer, you have missions that you are supposed to fulfill. Did you simply just focus on those missions and not worry about the strategic issues, or were there some challenges for you in reconciling those two?
At that time, Andrew, I had no challenges. I was focused on flying as best I could. I was challenged into resupplying Marines, medically evacuating them, transporting them. And that became an all-encompassing activity, an all-encompassing focus of my life. And doing it for the 13 months of my first tour was essentially my sole purpose in life. I still continued reading about the Vietnam War, about Vietnamese history, and about the Vietnam War that the French had not successfully prosecuted. But that did not interfere with my sense of noblesse oblige. As a Marine officer and a helicopter pilot, my only function in life was to fly for the Marine Corps and support the ground troops that we were engaged with.
Were these French sources that you were reading? I imagine most of them were, probably.
Many of them were. There were some by military officers, General Navarre, for example, but also a French sociologist, Paul Lemus, who wrote a book called Vietnam Sociology of the War. And I was struck by that book. I also read Vietnamese history written by Vietnamese authors. I read some North Vietnamese propaganda by Ho Chi Minh and others. I also read all of Bernard Fall's books on Vietnam. So I think I had a broad enough library shelf, if you wish, on Vietnam to give me varied sources from which I could then synthesize my own thoughts on the strategy. Yet, once again, my specific job there was to support ground troops in every way I could, and that's what I did.
So after you came home, after the first tour, how much of an interval did you have before you went back?
I had 4 months before going back, Andrew.
That's not very long.
It's not, and I volunteered to go back. And I think now, 50 years later, in retrospect, I suffered from I didn't do enough the first time. The Marines still need me to fly. And going back as a second tour officer, I bring a different breadth of experience, knowledge, and competence, and geographical understanding of where we were fighting, which served me well in the month of April 1970, when a mishap took place during a night medical evacuation and my helicopter was disabled. I had to go and make a forced landing. I knew where flat land was, and that's where I steered the helicopter to. And so bringing knowledge of the aircraft, knowledge of the geography, helped me be more productive in my second tour. And I felt that I was serving my country in the specifics of helping the Marines on the ground who depended on us for resupply, medical evacuations, and other kinds of support.
Did the Marines do air mobile operations similar to what the Army was doing with helicopters, or did you have a different function in the Marine Corps with aviation?
The Marine Corps did a fair amount of air assaults in various parts of the northern part of South Vietnam, I Corps, which was a theater of operation. I think the Army had significantly larger numbers of assets, the Hueys that they flew. We used CH-46s and H-34 helicopters with more limited numbers, but we did air assault a variety of places when needed, yes.
And you flew those missions in addition to resupply medevac missions as well?
Oh, absolutely, including during the Tet Offensive, when part of what we had to do was take back provincial capitals in and around the Da Nang area that had been taken by the North Vietnamese or the Viet Cong.
So Tet started just a few months after you arrived, right?
Less than 3 months. In my first tour.
That was quite a wake-up, I guess.
It was.
It was for many Americans at home, certainly. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people, with the benefit of hindsight, see that as a turning point in the war when Americans, sort of the middle of the country, so to speak, started to think maybe this wasn't going so well for us. David, why, you mentioned earlier that when you were back home between your two tours, you had a sense of guilt that you hadn't done enough. Why do you think you felt that way?
Part of it, I think, is I survived, and several of my friends from flight school, cadets or officers, did not. And so there's a certain thing called survivor guilt, which I think runs a thread through veterans of wars. The other thing is that I felt that as an instructor pilot in North Carolina, I was not contributing to what the function of the Marine Corps was, which was to help the ground troops. And so when the opportunity came up to return to Vietnam, I grabbed it. And I thought I was going to go back and do what was important, which was to support our ground troops in their operations in a war in which I no longer believed at all, if I had ever believed in it to begin with.
Did you feel, when you went back the second time, did you feel that attitude, the one you just mentioned about not believing in the war, was widely shared by your fellow Marines?
Did
you feel left out, kind of, or that you were missing something that other people felt?
It's difficult to generalize. As a pilot, you're in the cockpit, and the people in the back may be talking about a variety of things. And infantry units are larger in numbers than aviation squadrons. There's a different focus to what they do, so the discussions I was not aware of. One thing, Andrew, I did become aware of was the increased use of drugs, and that most specifically after Mr. Nixon announced the pullout. In the summer of 1970, the 9th Marine Regiment pulled out of the northern part of I Corps, the 9th Marine Regiment, which had been the first Marine ground unit in Vietnam in March of 1965. And I believe that the impression that I'm not going to be the last man to die in Vietnam started to spread among those who actually faced combat every day, which as a pilot, I did not. Some of the missions I flew were into hazardous and active fire zones. Many of them were not. A lot of the ground troops, however, faced these dangers every day. And so their perspective of Vietnamization, of withdrawal, was quite different than mine. I go back to the fundamentals of what I thought I should be doing, which is as a pilot in the Marine Corps, I have to support those ground troops who depend on me.
You mentioned your Marine Corps service. You introduced it, interestingly, in the context of sort of opportunity and social mobility, so to speak, in American society. And then you go to Vietnam, you come home after your second tour, and you entered college, correct?
That is true, yeah.
At San Diego State University. When you get home and you're starting school, what does the war mean to you now as a college student?
I was 8 years older than most of my contemporaries. We had nothing to talk about in common. And I think as many Vietnam vets, or perhaps other war veterans, you don't discuss your war with people who cannot connect to it. I did not discuss my Vietnam experience until about 20 years later, when I happened to be in our embassy in Ankara, meeting two foreign service officers who in the hallway mentioned, hey, do you know this is the 20th anniversary of Tet? And I said, you guys were there too? And they said, yep. And so all three of us went out to dinner that night in Ankara to a Vietnamese restaurant. And we started talking about it's our common experience. So there's, you can't share the kinds of experiences with people who don't have the common ground.
Well, that's always there. And then on top of that, you probably experienced a lack of interest from your classmates and so on. It seems that not many people wanted to talk about the Vietnam War in America. I mean, whether they served or not, there was just this willful forgetting going on.
Indeed. I don't recall any of my fellow classmates at San Diego State ever asking me. They knew that I was still flying for the Marine Corps Reserve at that time because I would chat about that. But that was flying in the U.S. and peacetime, if you want. 1970, the war was still going on, but I was a reserve Marine pilot doing peacetime operations. And I don't recall anyone asking me about the Vietnam experience. Sometimes they would ask me about how is it to fly around the Los Angeles basin in your helicopter with all the traffic, but nobody said something about either Tet Offensive or other.
So there's a researcher named Monica Higgins. She has this theory about how our early career experiences have an extremely powerful impression on us in formulating models for how we think of social relationships, effective and ineffective leadership, good organizational norms, values, what is a good culture in an organization, what's a bad culture in an organization. She calls this career imprinting, sort of analogizing from animals, right? When you're hatching, the first thing you see is what you imprint on, and that's mama, right? You know, as you look back on your the formative years of adulthood that you spent in the Marine Corps in Vietnam, how did those shape your attitudes towards the work that you did in your long, you know, an illustrious career in the State Department? How to what extent did those experiences imprint on you, and what were the lessons that you took from Vietnam that perhaps affected how you worked throughout your career?
I believe that the way that I served in the Marine Corps gave me the imprint of personal responsibility. Assume responsibility for your actions, for your leadership, and assume them in a full and complete way. I was very proud that the Marine Corps entrusted me with putting me through flight school, with flying as an aircraft commander in the H-46 helicopter, and I was responsible for the crew, for the passengers, for the cargo. So that sense of responsibility moved on to everything that I thought I did in the Foreign Service or even here at the War College. If you're responsible for something, you assume full responsibility. You don't delegate responsibility, and you do the work in the way that is expected of you by the organization in which you work.
Did you ever feel that that was different from the attitude that was prevalent amongst other people in your organization?
The Foreign Service, to some extent, is a very individually focused culture organization where, as a Foreign Service officer, very frequently you're rewarded for your analytical skills, for the way you have contacts with foreign government officials or trade unions or economic advisors. So it's a personal one-on-one type of relationship that many Foreign Service officers cultivate. Mm-hmm. Differently from the military, where group culture is really important. And so the sense of personal responsibility for the quality of the reporting an officer can do is high, but that does not necessarily engage others in the organization. That's, in a quick snapshot, if you wish, how I see the difference in the sense of responsibility.
Did you feel that your Marine Corps experience prepared you uniquely for challenges that you faced in your Foreign Service career? Or did you feel perhaps that you were at a disadvantage and you might have felt both at different times? I'm curious how that formative experience translated for you into the State Department.
I think a certain level of aggressiveness had to be tamed in my approach to my work. I tended to respond quickly. I tended to know what to do, and I looked up the regulations, looked up the procedures, and was prompt to action. And I realized that in the world in which I gravitated, I should maybe reflect more and not always give the first answer that came to my mind, even if I believed the answer was right. Reflection is good. It's useful. It gives the opponent time to maybe ask another question and gives you time to reflect. So I do think in my early years, I had to learn that. I once told an ambassador that he could not do something, and he was most annoyed because he just asked me if he could do it. As I left his office, the ambassador's deputy said to me that I was dumb. What I should have said is, "Oh, Mr. Ambassador, I'll look into that and get back to you." And then, a few days later, when it's no longer on the top of the ambassador's agenda, walk back in and say, "Oh, Mr. Ambassador, by the way, the question you asked me on Thursday, no, unfortunately, we cannot do that." And I said, "But I knew the answer already." And he said, "Bennett, you're dumb. It was the top of the ambassador's agenda when he asked you. Even if you knew the answer, you could have given yourself breathing space." And I always remember that comment from that deputy chief of mission, who was much wiser than I was then, and maybe than I am today.
Yeah, I have a version of that, that when someone asks you for something that you don't want to do or you want to defer, just tell them that you're getting your top people to work on it. We got our top people on it. So, David, last question, and this is also not an easy one, but today, you know, we're looking back on Vietnam 50 years later. Why should we remember the Vietnam War? What do you think?
During the Cold War, the Korean conflict and the Vietnam War were two of the significant war fighting actions. Other actions took place here and there, but Vietnam and Korea stand out historically as fairly significant military activities. So that's one reason. The other one is the sacrifice of over 58,000 young Americans who did what their country asked them to do. Whether they were willing or drafted matters not. The third thing is that unfortunately, as a country, we do things called lessons learned. But I don't think we have lessons remembered or lessons applied. And so it is useful, I believe, to go back and look at our history as a nation, as a republic, and look at various parts of it and say, what did we learn from that we can apply today? And these models are difficult, but there are countless periods in our history from which we can learn. I'm old enough to remember the Civil Rights Movement and the passage of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Acts right. I also remember last year in Charlottesville, Virginia, some riots which reminded me of those 50 years earlier. So we had lessons learned. We can go to libraries and read books about people who did the freedom marches, who kept their eyes on the prize, but we don't seem to apply those. And as long as we don't try to remember the lessons of our history, it'll be more difficult for us to try and apply the more positive lessons that we can extract from Korea, Vietnam, the civil rights movement, or other kinds of important aspects of the history of our republic.
One of the lessons that the nation seemed to learn immediately following the Vietnam War was a bit more circumspection regarding large military interventions globally, right? It takes a while for the U.S. to get back to a place where it's willing to make those kinds of significant commitments. And we have this creeping up to a greater willingness during the Reagan and Bush 1 administrations. You know, Grenada, Beirut is a failure, Panama, and then Desert Storm, right? And sort of Desert Storm is this great turning point in, it seems in hindsight, and this maybe is inaccurate, but it seems like that's a great turning point in terms of the perception of the effectiveness of the military in advancing U.S. interests globally. That now, you know, post-Vietnam, it's, well, you know, that didn't work out that well. I think we should be pretty cautious to a different perspective. Do you think that we need to be more circumspect about the use of the military globally, or do you think we're about the right place? What's your perception of that?
I think we should be more circumspect. I think, unfortunately, while the American military is brilliant, well-trained, well-equipped, it is overused in progressing, in pursuing American national interests without finite ends being clearly defined. The military took Iraq quickly in the Second Gulf War. And then what did we do with it? We as a nation didn't know what to do with it. We mishandled the transition. In Afghanistan, we're not doing much better. In Syria, we're not doing much better. To paraphrase Madeleine Albright, we've got a great military. Why don't we use it? If you have this kind of an equipment tool, the U.S. military, the tendency can be to try and use it to achieve objectives without clearly defining what those objectives are. And that is something Vietnam ought to have taught us. We did not win the war in Vietnam. People will say we didn't lose, but we did not really achieve any finite strategic ends.
I think our South Vietnamese allies would probably tell you that we lost.
Well,
but okay.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But we tend not to look back at the value of this historical example, mm-hmm. where perhaps the ends were not clearly defined, and we applied significant means in a whole wide range of ways, to use the War College ends, ways, and means paradigm, to achieve this. And military can achieve many great things. They cannot necessarily, or they cannot, in my judgment, ever achieve sound political ends anywhere they go.
Well, David, thank you so much for this discussion. I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us and to share your experiences, your insight, your wisdom, your perspective.
Andrew, thank you very much for this opportunity, and I hope I'm not hounded out of the War College.
Thank you again for joining us here in the War Room podcast, and we hope you'll join us next time.
And that concludes our program. Thank you for listening. The views expressed in this podcast reflect those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views, policies, or positions of the U.S. Army or the Department of Defense. Let us know what you think. Provide us your feedback, comments, or suggestions through our webpage at warroom.armywarcollege.edu. And have a great day.